voiceofafrica.com.
I'm VOA's Alexis Strobe with your worldwide news update. President Donald Trump discussed the war in Ukraine on Wednesday in phone calls with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino reports.
In a post on his social media platform after speaking to Putin, Trump said the two leaders had agreed that negotiations should start immediately. Russia occupies around a fifth of Ukraine and has demanded Kyiv cede more territory and be rendered permanently neutral under any peace deal. Ukraine demands Russia withdraw from captured territory and says it must receive NATO membership or equivalent security guarantees. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth on Wednesday said NATO membership was unrealistic, as was recovering the territory Ukraine had lost.
Chasing this illusionary goal will only prolong the war and cause more suffering.
Speaking from Kyiv Wednesday, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said a minerals deal between Kyiv and Washington would provide Ukraine with a so-called post-war security shield.
And we believe that this is an important signal to the world, to the Russian leadership, that we stand together.
Trump has said he wants $500 billion in rare earth minerals from Ukraine. Zelensky said Kyiv would study the draft agreement presented by the U.S.
That was Reuters correspondent Olivia Zelino. Israel's defense minister says all hell will break loose if Hamas does not release three hostages as planned this weekend. The threat on Wednesday comes as mediators work to keep the fragile ceasefire from collapsing. The militant group has accused Israel of failing to meet its commitments under the deal and threatened to delay the next release of hostages. A Hamas official now says there are positive signals for the release. The dispute has been a major test for the fragile ceasefire, along with President Donald Trump's proposal to relocate Palestinians out of devastated Gaza. This is VOA News. Tulsi Gabbard, a former U.S. representative with little intelligence experience, was sworn on Wednesday as the top U.S. spy. Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner reports.
Gabbard now will oversee the 18-agency intelligence community, including the CIA, and act as President Donald Trump's top advisor on intelligence issues. With little experience in this area, she was considered to be one of Trump's most controversial picks. Yet every Republican besides Senator Mitch McConnell, the party's former leader in the chamber, lined up behind the nominee. White House Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt was asked about this at her briefing Wednesday.
We're greatly disappointed in any Republican who chooses willfully to vote against the president's exceptionally qualified cabinet nominees and picks to lead his America First administration.
By comparison, no Democrats or independents voted in favor of Gabbard. Gabbard, a 43-year-old former Democrat, had faced bipartisan questions about past statements seen as supporting U.S. adversaries and lack of experience that would have prepared her to manage a $100 billion budget.
That was Reuters correspondent Freddie Joyner. Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban is hosting Alice Weidel, the alternative for Germany Party's candidate for chancellor, a rare meeting between a European leader and Germany's far-right party. Speaking at a news conference following their meeting Wednesday, Orban praised AfD, calling it the future, and endorsing its stance on immigration and the economy. The meeting signaled a shift in Orban's approach to AfD, which he previously kept at a distance. The ACLU sues for access to migrants flown to Guantanamo in February. AP correspondent Haya Panjwani reports.
Civil rights attorneys have sued the Trump administration to gain access to detained migrants who they say have been flown to Guantanamo Bay and held there without being able to consult lawyers or speak to relatives. American Civil Liberties Union lawyers filed the federal lawsuit in Washington, D.C. They say this is the first time in U.S. history that the government has detained non-citizens on civil immigration charges at the U.S. naval base in Cuba. For decades, the base primarily was used to detain foreigners associated with the September 11, 2001 attacks. Haya Panjwani, Washington.
Congo's largest church organizations have met with Rwanda-backed rebels in the country's east to advocate for peace and dialogue after weeks-long fighting. The meeting Wednesday comes weeks after the M23 rebels moved into Goma, the region's largest city, and captured it before advancing deeper into the neighboring South Kivu province. One of the church leaders, Bishop Donatien Nishol, said the meeting was an opportunity to seek an end to the war as soon as possible because we remain convinced the solution to this crisis is not military. The M23 rebels are the most prominent of more than 100 armed groups vying for control of Congo's mineral-rich east. That wraps up this update, but the world in news never stop. For additional updates, visit our website. I'm Alexis Strobe, VOA News.
Defense Secretary says returning to Ukraine's pre-war borders is unrealistic.
The Trump team are basically saying openly in the public domain what the Biden administration were never honest enough to say.
Israel is preparing for the fragile ceasefire with Hamas to fall apart.
On Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talked of ending the ceasefire deal if Hamas fails to return more hostages by Saturday. As well as mobilizing reservists, he's ordered the military to gather forces in and around Gaza.
And a look at Democratic opposition to President Trump in the U.S.
There's very little appetite to help Republicans when we don't trust that Donald Trump is going to spend the resources that we've allocated.
Today is Thursday, February 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Karish. U.S. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth said on Wednesday that NATO membership for Ukraine is unrealistic, and he suggested Ukraine set aside demands for a return to its pre-2014 borders. Hegseth's comments came during a meeting of the Ukraine Defense Contact Group at NATO's Brussels headquarters.
We will only end this devastating war and establish a durable peace by coupling Allied strength with a realistic assessment of the battlefield. We want, like you, a sovereign and prosperous Ukraine. But we must start by recognizing that returning to Ukraine's pre-2014 borders is an unrealistic objective. Chasing this illusionary goal will only prolong the war and cause more suffering.
In his remarks, Hegseth also said that NATO members need to significantly increase defense spending to 5% of their GDP because the United States will no longer tolerate an imbalanced relationship, and it will prioritize empowering Europe to own responsibility for its own security. Some Eastern European allies, like Poland, worry that Russian President Vladimir Putin will not stop at Ukraine's borders if he wins there, and that Russia poses an existential threat to their security. Secretary Hegseth's remarks might have come as a shock or a disappointment to some, but they also bring clarity to the Trump administration's position. For more, I'm joined by Taras Kuzio. He's a professor of political science at the National University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy.
Well, I think, judging by most of the press comments, they seem to have all got it wrong. And I think that's partly because there's a widespread bias against Donald Trump. And don't get me wrong, I'm not a fan of Donald Trump. But, you know, as a political scientist, I have to try and see how this plays out on both sides. And my view is that there isn't much of a difference between what Trump, what the Trump team have said today at the Ukraine Contact Defense Group meeting and what the Biden administration and prior to that, even Obama administration have said. I mean, the two key areas are NATO membership and territorial question. Well, firstly, and we all seem to forget that the last U.S. president to support Ukrainian membership of NATO was President Bush. So that's, we're talking 15 years ago. So two Democrat and one Republican president have opposed Ukraine joining NATO. De facto, NATO and the U.S. have given Russia a veto over Ukraine membership of NATO. And on the, so how is the Trump team different to the Biden and Obama administration on this question? It's not. Secondly, the territorial question. Again, there's, in many ways, the Trump team is actually being more honest than the Biden administration. The Biden administration's drip-drip policy was to provide enough military aid to Ukraine for it to be not defeated, but not enough to defeat Russia, not enough for Ukraine to be victorious. That was the Biden administration policy. There was never a Biden administration policy to for Ukraine to retake back its occupied territory. The Trump team are basically saying openly in the public domain what the Biden administration were never honest enough to say.
So would you see today's developments as positive?
No, it's no, they're not positive at all, I don't think. I mean, we haven't seen how everything's going to play out yet. I mean, you know, President Zelensky has actually said he's not even seen a peace plan yet. So I wouldn't say it's positive, but at the same time, it shows that there's a consensus in the American political elites, Democrats and Republicans, against Ukraine joining NATO and against providing a sufficient military equipment for Ukraine to retake and liberate its occupied territories. So the Trump team is not that much different from the Biden. What the big question mark is going to be, I think, how will the Trump team pressure Russia to sit at the table for talks? Because this, so far, what we've heard from the Trump team is something that Russia will never agree to.
How so? Why wouldn't Russia agree to this?
Russia won't agree to it because Russia's goals have not been met. The Kremlin's goals, shall we say. The Kremlin's goals in this war were always to destroy Ukraine as an independent state and to destroy Ukraine's identity, to transform the rump Ukraine minus the southeastern Crimea into a little Russia and as a Russian puppet state. That hasn't happened. Ukraine has managed to hold off Russia, and 80% of Ukraine is still free. Russia has not been successful even in capturing any large cities, which Russian nationalists say are Russian, like Kharkiv, Kiev, Odessa, for example. If the peace plan was proposed that froze the current conflict line, the Russia would never agree to it because it hasn't achieved its goals. And yet, at the same time, by May, there will have been 1 million Russian casualties. For what? The second reason Russia will not agree is that a frozen conflict would allow Russian territory to remain under Ukrainian control in Kursk. Again, the Kremlin would never agree to that. So I do not foresee the Kremlin sitting down and negotiating unless they're forced to do, and that means the Trump administration have to work on increasing military aid to Ukraine and increasing economic and energy sanctions. If they don't do that, now, of course, there is a potential scenario that the Kremlin wants. The Kremlin wants a second Yalta, where Trump and Putin sit down and basically carve up spheres of influence. Now, if that were to happen, then Putin would gladly sit down with Trump. But I don't think that's going to be the case.
One of the other things that Secretary Hegseth said earlier today was that going forward, Europe would have to pay more to protect Ukraine, that Europe would be taking the lion's share of the cost, both in terms of money and in terms of manpower. Do you think that seeds American power and influence away from the U.S. towards Europe? Makes the U.S. weaker on the continent?
Well, I mean, again, the Trump administration here has played, you know, there are two individuals that have forced Europe to increase defense spending, Trump and Putin. When Russia first invaded Ukraine in 2014, only five NATO members spent 2% of GDP on defense. Today, it's about two-thirds of NATO members. So the Trump administration's complaints about that are actually very justified, especially when those same countries who were not spending money on defense were actually in bed with Russia on, for example, energy questions. The big question mark, which nobody has answered and they can't answer, is it really realistic for Europe on its own, without U.S. military support, to create a kind of peacekeeping force for the frozen conflict line? I think that's unrealistic. And a second, I think, related question is that today was mentioned that this peacekeeping force would have nothing to do with NATO and could not call on Article 5 of NATO. That sends a signal to Russia that they can play mischief with this peacekeeping force. And I think that's also something that it doesn't look very, very, very good. So I think we have tremendous areas and problems to discuss as to where, how do you create security guarantees? Where are the troops going to come from? Especially when you have a very suspicious country, Ukraine, which has already been betrayed once with the Budapest Memorandum. In 2014, Britain and the US betrayed Ukraine. They ignored their commitments. So Ukraine will not agree to flimsy security guarantees.
Taras Kuzio teaches political science at the National University of Kyiv Mohyla Academy. Professor Kuzio, thanks so much for your time. Thanks for your analysis.
Thank you.
And in a related story, earlier on Wednesday, President Trump spoke with Russian President Vladimir Putin on the phone. Reuters' Olivia Zelino gets us caught up.
Donald Trump on Wednesday discussed the war in Ukraine in separate phone calls with Russian President Vladimir Putin and Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky. It's the U.S. president's first big step towards diplomacy over a war he has promised to end. In a post on his social media platform after speaking to Putin, Trump said the two leaders had agreed that negotiations should start immediately. Putin and Trump also agreed to meet, the Kremlin said, and Putin invited Trump to visit Moscow. Putin last spoke to a sitting U.S. president in February 2022, a call with Joe Biden shortly before ordering thousands of troops into Ukraine. At the White House on Wednesday, Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt said the Trump administration was committed to ending the war.
I myself just spoke to the president about these calls, and he told me to tell all of you they were very good calls, they were very positive, and the administration is wholeheartedly committed to a peace deal to end once and for all the Russia-Ukraine war.
Russia occupies around a fifth of Ukraine and has demanded Kyiv cede more territory and be rendered permanently neutral under any peace deal. Ukraine demands Russia withdraw from captured territory and says it must receive NATO membership or equivalent security guarantees to prevent Moscow from attacking again. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth on Wednesday said NATO membership was unrealistic, as was recovering the territory Ukraine had lost.
Chasing this illusionary goal will only prolong the war and cause more suffering.
Speaking from Kyiv Wednesday, U.S. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said a minerals deal between Kyiv and Washington would provide Ukraine with a so-called post-war security shield.
And we believe that this is an important signal to the world, to the Russian leadership, that we stand together.
Trump has said he wants $500 billion in rare earth minerals from Ukraine. Zelensky said Kyiv would study the draft agreement presented by the U.S., adding that he hoped they could seal a deal at a meeting later this week in Munich with U.S. officials, including Vice President J.D. Vance.
That's Olivia Zelino of Reuters reporting. Turning now to the Middle East, the tenuous ceasefire between Israel and Hamas is being tested, and Israel is preparing to resume military action if the hostages don't come home as planned. Fiona Jones of Reuters has that story.
Israel's military has called up reservists in preparation for a possible resumption of fighting in Gaza. That's amid growing concern that the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas will collapse as fury mounts in Arab countries over U.S. President Donald Trump's plan for the enclave.
The U.S. will take over the Gaza Strip.
Trump proposed that the U.S. takes over Gaza, resettles its Palestinian inhabitants, and builds an international beach resort.
But the Riviera of the Middle East, this could be something.
On Tuesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu talked of ending the ceasefire deal if Hamas fails to return more hostages by Saturday. As well as mobilizing reservists, he's ordered the military to gather forces in and around Gaza. Hamas has suspended the handover agreed in the deal, accusing Israel of violating its terms. The standoff threatens to reignite a conflict that has devastated the Gaza Strip and pushed the Middle East to the brink of a wider war. Gazans like Abdul Rahman al-Habibi expressed alarm that the ceasefire might collapse.
Israel must release the prisoners and abide by the agreements, and Hamas must also adhere to the agreements for the sake of the people. The people are in pain and sick. The people are completely exhausted. There is no country in the world that is protecting these people.
And Lotfi Abu Taha said he has been displaced seven times, one of the tens of thousands to flee their homes.
From the moment we heard this news, our hearts sank. The whole country was shaken. We had barely started believing that a truce would happen and that a solution was on the way, God willing. We are calling on Hamas and we are calling on Israel. We ask them to reach an agreement and put an end to this situation. The people are suffering. The people are the victims.
Hamas said it remained committed to the agreement, but has not agreed to release the hostages on Saturday. Egypt will host an emergency Arab summit on February the 27th to discuss, quote, serious developments for Palestinians.
That's Fiona Jones of Reuters reporting. And here are some more stories we're following from around the world. For a second year in a row, the Israel-Hamas war accounted for the most journalist deaths, according to data released Wednesday by the Committee to Protect Journalists. The report says that of the 124 journalists killed in 2024, 82 of them died in Gaza. Sudan and Pakistan follow with 6 deaths each, and Mexico with 5. Security and military sources report significant increases in Islamic State group movements in Iraq between Kirkuk and Salahuddin, with militants seen wearing military uniforms and carrying advanced weapons. Despite efforts to suppress the group, officials warn that IS remains a security threat and is taking advantage of political instability to reorganize and strengthen its presence, particularly in Arab villages. As Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi heads to the United States for a 2-day visit starting Wednesday, officials in New Delhi expressed optimism that the visit will herald a renewed and substantive partnership. However, analysts said both countries must navigate contentious issues on trade and immigration. New Delhi, which wants to avoid trade tensions with the U.S., announced earlier this month that it would lower tariffs on some items that would benefit American exports, such as high-end motorcycles and cars. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Karish. Turning now to the U.S. and domestic politics. Democratic lawmakers are criticizing what they call the Trump administration's extreme efforts to reshape the U.S. government, and they're vowing to oppose those changes despite limited political capital in both chambers of the U.S. Congress. Republicans, however, defend the move, saying attempts to stop fraud and waste are long overdue. VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson has the story.
A second week of protests from Democratic lawmakers concerned about President Donald Trump's attempts to reshape the U.S. government. Despite limited political capital in both chambers of the U.S. Congress, Democrats vowing to fight what they call the Trump administration's extreme efforts to close down government agencies and immediately lay off federal workers. Chuck Schumer is the top Democrat in the U.S. Senate.
If you want to make cuts, then you do it through a debate in Congress, not lawlessly by just implementing them. We want waste. We want to make sure waste isn't done, but they're cutting out the meat that's going to hurt millions of American families.
Republicans have defended the work of the Department of Government Efficiency, or DOGE, led by billionaire Elon Musk, saying attempts to stop fraud and waste are long overdue. Tom Emmer serves in House Republican leadership.
The Democrat Party's tantrums are exactly why they hold no majority in Congress and their candidate is not in the White House. DOGE is rightly pulling back the curtains that have been closed for years. And the outrage we are seeing across the aisle is baffling but not surprising, given their record of mismanagement of taxpayer dollars.
Democrats are vowing to fight for protections for government agencies or withhold their votes in upcoming government funding talks. Pete Aguilar serves in House Democratic leadership.
There's very little appetite to help Republicans when we don't trust that Donald Trump is going to spend the resources that we've allocated for education, for health care, or even, we don't know, for our own defense. With Elon Musk and his unelected friends running through and combing through the federal system.
Democrats have had some success temporarily stopping Trump's executive orders in the U.S. court system. But one analyst told VOA other changes will take time.
Casey Burgat is Legislative Affairs Program Director at the George Washington University.
We haven't yet seen the grassroots mobilization yet, but that's the one most indirect to levers of power within Washington, D.C. It takes time for those messages to resonate with the American people, them to coordinate with each other to gain enough volume to reach members of Congress or enough members of Congress.
But Speaker of the House Mike Johnson said Tuesday the Democratic Party has very little power.
There's no identified leader of the party. They don't have a clear vision. They seem rudderless. In hopes of finding themselves, they've latched onto this new shiny object called the rule of law. Well, we'd like to welcome them to the concept. It would be admirable if they hadn't spent the last 4 years with their heads buried in the sand while Biden literally trampled over the rule of law with no objection.
The short-term agreement funding the U.S. government is set to expire March 14th. Catherine Gibson, VOA News, Washington.
And finally today, at least 16 Pakistanis have died in a migrant boat accident off the coast of Libya. Pakistani officials said on Tuesday, survivors of a migrant boat rescued in January in the Atlantic Ocean near Morocco have come home in recent days with harrowing stories to tell. VOA's Pakistan Bureau Chief Sarah Zaman met with a survivor and relatives of victims to find out why young Pakistani men are willing to risk their lives to get to Europe.
Walking with an injured foot, Amir Ali says he's lucky to be alive. The 21-year-old was stranded with over 80 others on a migrant boat in the Atlantic Ocean for almost 2 weeks in January, trying to reach Spain illegally from Mauritania.
I used to just rinse my mouth with ocean water, but it was too salty. It would cause bleeding. My whole mouth was bleeding. One day, all the men performed ablutions to cleanse their bodies as a last rite.
22 Pakistanis survived, but at least 43 perished before Moroccan authorities rescued them. About an hour away from Ali's home in rural central Punjab province of Pakistan, a roadside sign memorializes two cousins who died. Haji Shaukat Ali is waiting for his son's body.
I don't know where my son's body is, whether it's on the shore or in the water. I just want him to be buried here.
Most of the survivors belong to small towns and villages between the capital Islamabad and the country's second largest metropolis, Lahore. This region is a hub for migration, both legal and illegal. Europe is a popular destination. Dure Nayab is a demographer.
It's not just the financial aspect. The two other aspects that came out were lifestyle, and somehow they thought that they'll gain more respect out of country.
Kashif Ali, who has come for his cousin's funeral, agrees. Ali moved to Italy a decade ago. He spent thousands of dollars for a work visa.
There, they give us rights. We pay taxes, and against that, the government takes care of issuing us documents and securing our children's future.
Experts say other success is also a driving force.
Multi-story houses like these built with money earned overseas dot central Punjab. This display of wealth also inspires many to take a big risk, hoping for a big reward.
Amir Ali paid nearly $10,000 to human smugglers. He has come back traumatized. Still, his cousins say they are willing to sell family assets like he did to fund their European dream.
Of course, everyone wishes that if someone else has gone, why am I still here?
The future is great in Europe. There's work. There's money.
Since 2023, hundreds of Pakistanis have died trying to get to Europe by boat. Pakistan has arrested several alleged human smugglers and fired dozens of officials in recent weeks for failing to curb illegal migration. Experts say unless the country turns its economy around, keeping people from finding risky ways out will remain a challenge. Sara Zaman, VOA News, District Gujarat, Punjab, Pakistan.
And that'll wrap it up for today. This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Steve Karish.